You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Hey, this is OneOfUs.net. I'm Bo Paul, and I'm here with Chris Cox, and we have been fortunate enough to score an interview with the Nelms brothers. Anybody who's been listening to the site for a while and checked out our review for Small Town Crime knows that we were amazingly enamored of this great little character actor-driven neo-noir film, and the Nelms reached out to us. They enjoyed our review so much that they wanted to talk a little bit about their upcoming Blu-ray release. And Chris and I just sat down and watched some of the special features on that, and so we're going to roll right into our interview with the Nelms brothers. Guys, introduce yourself.
Hello, Ian Nelms.
And this is Esham Nelms. And
thank you for having us.
Absolutely, yeah, so it's pretty tricky to take us apart as our voice, as our speaking pattern has sort of
melded
together over the years.
I'm used to it. Two of my friends are filmmakers who do a podcast with me who are twin brothers, so it's even more so. People are like, wait, which one was that?
Yeah, you guys are at least, we can tell you visually apart, so. Well, you know, speaking on that, you know, I'm a little bit curious as to, you know, obviously I felt that this was kind of an auteur-driven film. It's, you know, very much your guys' imprint upon it. How do you guys deal with that as a tag team? Not only as, you know, people who are related to each other, but just two people instead of one.
Most of our battles are fought and won in the writing room. Mm-hmm. So when we're putting the script together, you know, we're also jamming about how it's going to look, and oh, we're going to shoot it this way, we're going to do this, and then we track in, and blah blah blah. So we're pretty synced up by the time the script's done. And if we do battle over something, we usually, and those are rare because we usually just work it out until we find a center line to agree upon. But if for some reason something's like, I don't see it, you know, we'll either act it out for each other and win the person over, or the most passionate person wins.
Is there any kind of clear division of labor? Like, is one of you more of the plot guy and one of you more of the dialogue guy, or is that, you know, just kind of an even Steven deal?
I mean, I think as we've done, you know, even I've been doing cinema together now for over a decade, and as we've gone along here, we've become more and more dysfunctionally codependent. I feel like now we've leaned into each other's strengths. You know, Ian, we'll start jumping on an idea, get excited about something, whether that's a scene or the plot of a picture. And then Ian's a machine. He'll just run off and like hammer that out. And so I'll wake up at 6 a.m. and like pages will show up. And I'm like,
So you're like, you know, I had a notion, and then he's hitting you over the head with a part of the script.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, damn, I wanted to write that. And so ultimately, you know, sometimes that happens. Ian's really tenacious for the writing, but then it's, I'll revise and I'll pass back to him. He'll revise, pass back to me. So we leap and springboard as to who's writing, who takes the first writing step, but it's that back and forth revision process that really, I think, synthesizes the work for us.
And by the end of the day, I mean, I usually will do like a vomit draft of something, but like by the end of the day, we can't even tell who's like,
sure.
You know, especially so many revisions, I can't tell who wrote what by the end of it. Neither can he.
Yeah, there's a couple lines in Small Town. I'm like, did I write that or did you write that? Like,
we wrote that.
No, I can, because I used to write while I was drinking, and I would wake up and go, did I write that? It seems like it.
And also to like a full meal in front of you. I wanted to ask you guys about your influences for this. Now, I'm watching this and I'm feeling Jim Thompson in here, like the writer. Does that feel like an actor?
We've heard that. We've absolutely heard that before, but yeah. I am not overly familiar with Jim Thompson's work. People are like, oh yeah, it's Jim Thompson. It's Jim Thompson. I'm like, shit, I don't read enough Jim Thompson. I don't know if I've ever read it.
He's on our queue now.
You should see that. You should see The Getaway at least.
Yeah, it's great.
Either version.
And it feels like Jim Thompson, but with filtered through Shane Black. You know what I mean? With that,
sure.
That sort of sensibility where there's a wry witticism in the midst of all this darkness that really makes it that much more palatable, where you're like, wow, this main character, you really, really like him, partially because, well, hell, he's kind of funny.
That was early on, that was one thing we learned is like, you know, win the audience over with humor early. And I mean, in this case, it certainly was in our minds of like, let's try to get, cause he goes down a pretty dark place. Let's get him laughing and let's get him, you know, you hooked into this guy's charisma.
I just got to throw in and say that the sequence where he gets up and starts you know, with the massive hangover, starts working out with weights. How did you guys come up with that? Because it's such a genius way of making you just relate to this guy, because you're already like, oh, I've thrown up like that before.
I guess for us, it was just indicative of Mike's tenacity.
Right.
There was nothing, this was such a habit for him and a habitualization that he would, you know, that's just part of his day is being that hungover. And for us, it was like, this shows that there's so much resilience in Mike, there's so much determination that he will just work through that.
I will say, as far as relating this to like a real life event, it was fortunately, it wasn't me personally, but, I went to college on a wrestling scholarship, and so I wrestled. I wrestled all year round. We trained all year round, whether we were in competition or not. And there were plenty of times where, you know, someone would come in either, you know, a little drunk from the night before and have to run the stairs, which was incredibly grueling, or lift weights, also grueling the way we did it. And would end up throwing up on the stairs or in the gym somewhere. It happened quite frequently. And you have to keep going.
But and also, Ian came back from college with this Division I workout, and myself and a couple other friends embarked on trying to do this workout with him. And we all
God, why? No.
Time where you feel like you're going to challenge yourself as a human, and we all lost that endeavor. I mean, I remember I vomited, our buddy Mike vomited, like everybody like that went and tried to do this workout with me and vomited. So I think like for us, like working out maybe is synonymous with you know, losing your
It sounds like a Python sketch. Just this pucatorium going on.
That's perfect.
Oh shit! It's Mr. Creosote.
So one of the things on the that was pointed out on the Blu-ray extras is that in that scene that we were just talking about, Mike has this row of skateboards behind him, and that was part of his, you know, kind of backstory that he's an ex skater, which I love because I can totally picture it. And you know, Hawks used to live in Austin. And like one of his very first things that he did film wise was actually one of the first Butthole Surfers videos.
Awesome.
Yeah, well worth seeking out. He's hilarious in it. But yeah, and he played in punk bands here. So it, like as soon as that was mentioned, I was like, oh yeah, that's perfect because I can totally see Hawks on a skateboard. Where was that coming from as far as you know, when you sat down to, and obviously we're approaching, you know, the idea that we want to immediately make this guy likable for all of his flaws. How did you create this backstory for Mike?
That was very much Esham's side of the table.
Well, this really. With the skateboards, definitely. I mean, I skateboarded in high school. I have an affection for skateboarding. I happened to happened to work with Stacy Peralta a couple times on a couple gigs. Nice. And so nice. I'm just a fan of him and his boards and Dogtown Z Boys and all that stuff. And so we just thought it'd be really cool to bring that element into Mike and to see that, I mean, there's no dialogue in that opening scene where he's working out. So like to throw as many pieces at you as that we could in that opening salvo there without any dialogue. And as far as like the music, it's interesting because John actually, when we sat down with John and started talking about this character, he actually brought a lot of music to us as far as like the punk scene and sort of, you know, he brought us the Animals.
Was he playing on the set at all? Cause he's, you know, John's a great guitarist and you know, he and his wife are great musicians. Did you have any of that on set?
He brought his guitar and he would plunk around a little bit. But shortly after that, he put down an album. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was right before we left. I think right before we left, he recorded an album, his new album.
And we put one of his songs in the bar when he gets kicked out. He's nice. Playing in the bar when he gets kicked out. But John told us when he was doing something, like when we were shooting, like about, I don't know, three quarters of the way through the shoot, he said, hey, you know, I just keep hearing Good Time by the Animals.
Nice.
And we're like, well, and he's like, are you familiar with that? We're not familiar with it, but, you know, when we, like, let's hear it. And he's like, do you know what you're going to put over that garage scene? Mm-hmm. Because we had written in something different. We're like, well, and then, but through working with John, that character had changed and evolved. I'm like, well, we're not sure, but when we hear it, it'll be a sledgehammer. We'll know it needs to go there.
And so he's like, well, listen to this Animals track. And I don't know, a couple weeks, we were slammed. A couple weeks later, we listened to it, and it was that epiphany moment. We're like, oh my God, this has to be nice. Mike Kendall's anthem.
Yeah.
It has to be this song, and it needs to bookend the movie.
It definitely needs to start
Mike, and it tells you so much about the guy.
Yeah, the song makes the scene sometimes. So the song makes the man in films often, and that is one of those moments. It feels to me like when y'all were writing this thing, the character was not exactly how he ended up being by the time he got to the final screen. Like, he evolved through John Hawks's involvement with the script to the point where, hearing you guys talk about him, it sounds like y'all have fallen in love with him to the point I would not be shocked to hear y'all announce there's another project about this character coming out down the line.
We hope.
we would love to do one. But yeah, it's all timing and people's schedules, and you know, does anybody want to buy a TV series of that? Or so, I mean,
but, you can just reshoot the story from Clifton Collins' point of view for my money, and I would watch that.
Well, here's my idea: period piece where he first gets involved and interested in detective work in the 80s as a young skateboarder. The Dogtown and Dogtown and Z Boys, the CSI series.
How he got hooked on police work.
Yeah, exactly.
We definitely know had a blast shooting with all of the tribe there. I mean, Octavia, John, Anthony, Clifton, Robert. I mean, God, every day we came to work, it was an absolute joy. We couldn't wait to sit down and collaborate with these amazing talents.
Well, it really sounds like from the extras on the Blu-ray, you kind of tell the story of you know, you kind of lucked out in just getting Octavia, and that looped in more people, and then John looped in more people. And you know, could you describe a little bit about the casting process and how you kind of built outward from you know, whoever the initial casting choice was?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were working on another project with Octavia Spencer, and she was like, "Okay, what are y'all working on?" And we had just finished the trailer for Waffle Street, the movie we shot right before this, very different. And so she starts watching it. She's like, "Oh my God, y'all got Danny Glover!" Like, pumped up because she loved Danny Glover. She grew up watching him. She loves him. And she's like, "What y'all doing next?" And we're like, she loved the trailer to that film. And she's like, "What y'all doing next?" And we're like, "Oh, we're doing this crime thriller, way different than that." And she's like, "Oh, you know, I love crime thrillers." She does. I mean,
yeah.
She's always watching. It was right around the time Making of a Murder had come out.
And
was very much like, I could see it in his eyes. I mean, she's just like, she really gets into it. And so we were like, yeah, we'll take a look at this lookbook. We show her the lookbook. She's like, ooh, I got to read that. So she read it within like 24 hours, and she called us. She's like, okay, I'm EPing this. I want to do a role in it, and like, bring your list over. Let's start talking about who's going to be Mike Kendall. And then when we sat down with her, we all just landed right on John Hawks.
How did he come up? Was Octavia familiar with him, or is he just were you guys fans?
She had done a couple movies with him, and he was on our list as well. And Ian and I, look, Ian and I have loved him in Winter's Bone.
He's so amazing.
I mean, the range he has is just incredible. Yeah. He's so utterly.
The first time I saw Winter's Bone, because my you know, and I had known him from around town, and then had you know, obviously playing Saw on Deadwood, but his role in Winter's Bone was just chilling, and I didn't know that he had that within him. It was amazing.
And it's funny, he's played a lot of very strong supporting characters over the years, like very unforgettable. This is, feels like everyone should have seen this movie, because this is his – this guy can carry an entire movie. I mean, despite the enormous, incredible supporting cast you've got here, I mean, everyone – come on, Clifton Collins Jr., holy shit. But Hawks is such a like fascinating character that you just want to keep following. You want to hear everything he has to say. You're frustrated when the movie ends because you just want more of him. I think this is a star-making turn for him and for you guys as well, certainly. I hear y'all got some solid contracts locked down because of this movie.
Well, thank you. Thanks, guys. You know, honestly, I mean, you come out the other side of these things, and these are like 2 years of your life.
Yeah,
sure. Movies, and it's good to come out the other side and have something that people enjoy and an audience reacts positively to. So
thank everybody, you guys so much. Everybody that was a part of it can be proud of, you know. It was a great experience. John really just brought it. Like, when we first sat down with him, he was like, okay, I think he'd only had it like 2 or 3 days, and he was like, okay, I've only read it 3 times. And we're like, oh damn, like, okay, he's read this thing 3 times already.
And then we just start talking to him about it. And that's part of his process. He just keeps diving deeper and deeper and reading it over and over and over and asking us questions and like really trying to just push and stretch into the shadows and depths of that character.
And no spoilers for the Blu-ray extras, but he does go kind of dive into his process on this. And it's worth buying the DVD for that alone if you're an actor.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I enjoyed the Blu-ray extras for the fact that most extra features like the making of are really kind of puff pieces. It's the actors talking about how much they like working with each other. It's the directors talking about how much they like working with the actors. You guys actually talk about all these technical aspects of how you got certain shots and things that were like, oh, wow, this was really difficult to do, but here's how we solved that problem. That is not the sort of thing you usually encounter, which is part of why I'm like, you guys are really technical directors. Y'all love that nitty gritty of figuring out all the details. Was that something y'all planned on ahead of time when you were doing these bonus features? Like, we wanted to make this not just your average little like, oh, I love them, they're great.
I feel like anytime we would watch, I mean, we were probably just trying to sort of say what we were hoping someone would say while we were watching commentaries or behind the scene features when we were watching them, trying to learn about filmmaking and films and just being, or even before that, just being excited about a movie or something. And we're watching the behind the scene features, just trying to gain some insight on how it was made or why the characters took certain choices. So I think that was in our head when we were doing it. And so, I mean, it's hard. We definitely had a wonderful time, but we were just trying to get as much information out there as possible.
And I think it just comes with the process of doing this stuff. And you don't realize how much thought and premeditation and planning it takes to pull off these, like, you know, two seconds of footage in a movie. It's a cut, you know? And so I don't know, for us, you know, the more we dive into doing shootouts and stuff like that and the logistics of that stuff, the challenges at times seem insurmountable, but you just go and you just put one, you know, plod one foot in front of the other, and the next thing you know, you got to put together. But yeah, I don't know. I've been hoping it would be somewhat enlightening on the process of how to do some of this stuff.
Yeah, because it certainly would have been daunting to us just sitting down, maybe as a new filmmaker, maybe as you hadn't shot something yet, but you're thinking about shooting something, and just, yeah, the process is, it can look daunting or look intimidating or, yeah, I mean, we're trying to get as much info, I think, about filmmaking out there as possible, because that's what I would want to hear.
And we definitely came from a DIY school of getting it done. I mean, Ian and I mean, when we first started this, I had been rear-ended in a car accident. I took the money instead of getting my car repaired. We bought the DVX-100 camera, and we just started making movies, Renegades, in the streets of LA. And so, in through that process, you know, you learn some tricks the hard way, and that's, we want to help people shortcut that process.
You know, let's get a little origin story. If you could kind of give us that on how you guys came about into doing this in the first place. You know, obviously, so you turned this a car accident into an opportunity. But where are the roots there? How did you guys come to want to become filmmakers?
Well, I think when we first fell in love with movies, it was just strictly for the art form. So we didn't have aspirations in high school or even until later in college that we wanted to do cinema for a career. We lived in the Central Valley, California, and grew up on movies like Terminator, Predator, Aliens. Those were like our sort of like, that's right. What we loved. And you look at those movies from a craft and a technical point of view, they're utterly overwhelming for a layperson. I think now, with the prevalence of special features and that information being out there and everything on Facebook, like, here's how you do all your green screen stuff and stuff like that. It's everyone's a little bit more informed, but that movies came from some faraway land. And so Ian was, wrestling his way through college, being a complete badass. And ultimately in his third year, he fell in love with literature and started doing plays and writing and just devouring, all sorts of materials. And then I went away to art school after giving up on trying to become a professional paintball player.
There's a limited field of like openings there for that.
It's certainly a loss to the form of paintball, but it's cinema's gain.
I still love the game. I play to this day, and the shootout.
Is that why you were late? You were playing paintball?
No. I wish. No, I only play on Sunday, but. No, I think I went away to art school, and I wasn't having a great time there. I was getting pressured to do a lot of abstract art, and I felt like my tendency was more towards figurative and more towards comic book and illustrated stuff. And I came back from art school pretty disenchanted, and Ian was falling in love with literature, and we had this epiphany moment where, like, holy smokes, we should do movies.
So aside, that's so were you doing any of the storyboard art for Small Town Crime?
Oh yeah, he's a professional storyboard artist.
Okay,
we landed in town. It took him about a year to kind of get the way to do it down. He's always a good enough artist. He's a great artist, but there's a certain way and a speed and a process to it that you kind of have to get under your belt. You can't just be a great artist.
Sure. No, I got a friend, Mark Bristol, who's a storyboard artist himself. And yeah, it's definitely it's a different process than making comic book or anything like
that. And you did work on some comic books, am I correct?
No, I haven't ever done any comic book art. I do more like shooting boards and stuff like that. I've done, you know,
concept art,
bunches of stuff like that. I've done some animatics and some stuff that's been, I've done some special feature artwork, like in Bones Brigade, you know, like little drawings for that documentary, stuff like that. But I think I was more painterly and then shifted more into comic books. And it's just a different way of drawing. I mean, when I went to art school, you have a model, you have a subject matter in front of you, and you're doing your interpretation of that subject. Storyboards is completely inventive. You know, you have to conjure up this perspective and all that stuff out of the noggin there. You have nothing to really reference. And so that's just a different set of tools that you learn how to do. But it comes in really handy in our process. Ian and I storyboard every shot of the movie. And we can just go and we bring our boards and we hand them out every day to everybody. And we just cross the shots off as we go through our day.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a very effective process. So going into a little bit about, you know, how we arrive at Small Town Crime, were you guys noir fans? Were you guys fans of the detective novel? Or what's a little background there? You mentioned that you weren't really up on your Jim Thompson, but were there any other authors or filmmakers that really kind of made you go like, man, I really want to make a noir movie?
Or a film that you're like, I want to make a movie like that, but my own thing.
Yeah.
I would say the impetus of it is completely our mom's fault.
Wait, is she a femme fatale?
Goodness. She's a big fan of Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
As you should be.
She bought the Clint Eastwood collection. And every 2 weeks, we would get another Clint Eastwood classic in the mail, another cassette. They would mail it to us. And we got everything from, you know, everything. Iger Sanction.
The original Beguile.
Any Which Way But Loose, the Monkey movies. all the Westerns, Leone Westerns, mm-hmm. Josie Wales, anything you could think of. And one of the, obviously, that relates to this, the Westerns and the whole
Dirty Harry franchise.
You know, I mean, that was a big influence on us. We wore the hell out of those. Those and the Leone Westerns, we wore them out, man. We couldn't get enough of them. Mm-hmm. We kept watching them over and over. And I think that, like, this is probably a very simplistic way to think of it is kind of a melding of those two for this movie. It has a Western aesthetic.
Sure.
With some noir tropes interwoven.
Southern Gothic, I guess, is what they're saying, calling it now, kind of.
What is it?
Southern Gothic noir?
Oh yeah,
Californian Gothic.
Yeah, Californian Gothic.
And I think as far as there's also another like amalgam of stuff we've always enjoyed, like the Sam and Twitch series and
Nice.
Pelicanos. So there's just a bunch of influences coming in that sort of
and of course cool. Like the modern filmmakers that are just killing it, like Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson. Who else? Yeah, like Shane Black for sure. I mean, those movies were seminal when we were kids.
Are there any smaller like up and coming directors right now that you've seen stuff by? You were like, wow, that guy is or gal is amazing.
Blue Ruin's amazing.
Blue Ruin's pretty seminal.
Yeah, Macon Blair is pretty amazing.
Stuff is fantastic. Macon Blair stuff is fantastic.
It's a really exciting time for people to be making movies. A lot of really great stuff being made. So yeah. I don't know. We're thrilled. We always get excited when we see the new releases coming out because it's just. I feel like there's a lot of great material pushing the boundaries.
So one thing about Small Town Crime is that in a little way, it's also kind of a car movie because you feature two incredible cars in this, a souped up Chevy Nova and of course a lowride Impala for Clifton Collins character. Are you guys car guys or, you know, how did that find its way into the movie? Because the Nova is so representative of Mike. It's so emblematic.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad you dug that.
Esh is the car guy. that is, growing up in the Central California,
sure,
there's a massive Latino Hispanic
community,
and I mean, lowriders are prevalent, man. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. And whether you're young kids putting together a badass lowrider bike, or
I mean, I rode a lowrider bike in high school. I built it from scratch.
Or whether you're putting together your badass ride. I mean, we saw a ton of them when we were growing up, and you know, there's some fucking amazing ones. Mm-hmm. And the hydraulics were always incredibly impressive. Mm-hmm. There was a stretch, a boulevard where these guys would cruise and they'd show off their hydraulics and compete. Goof around. It was part of a culture where we grew up. So I mean, it's funny because when we would screen it or people watch it and comment on Cliff's car, they're like, you know, some people I think who didn't grow up in a community where those are prevalent were just like, holy shit, what is that? You know, like, holy shit, like they were just blown away by it. And then the muscle car, we had a buddy that had one.
And one more thing.
Hold on. Can y'all say that again? Our audio went out for a second.
Yeah, we had a little.
We shot the movie in Utah. Mm-hmm. It's really not the easiest thing to find a tricked out Impala lowrider in Utah.
No.
But we found it, and we were very specific. Like, one.
You found the one Mormon cholo in the entire state of Utah.
But we found it. I remember we passed this guy in like a sweet dumped Lincoln or whatever one day, and we're like, that was a lowrider. Turn around. We pulled back and we flagged the guy down, and he was like, "Yo, what's up?" And we're like, "Do you know anybody with an Impala?" He's like, "Oh yeah, my homie's got an Impala." So they're like, "We got a car club here, so we found that we ended up with any purple Impalas, and bam, there it was." So we're really, really grateful to the gentleman that let us use that car for the show, because we were very specific. Like, it has to have hydraulics, because for us, it's fun to see that car coming in its utter sort of glorious absurdity and squat on the ground. You know?
Oh well, yeah, and I mean that. When that comes in, that it's just such an of course moment. Because we're like, yes, that is his car.
Yeah, I'm from the East Coast, so
that thing, it was his.
Yeah. Well, I'm from the East Coast, so still every time I see one of those, I think it's going to turn into a transformer. I'm just like, and nothing else makes sense. I'm like, why is it doing that? Look at it; it's going to change.
was one of the things that Cliff was. Like, we were talking, we wrote it into the script, and like, really, it pulls up, squats down, he delivers his line. I mean, we had all those little beats in there that he thought were hysterical, that we thought were hysterical as well. And he was just like, are we going to be able to find that car? We didn't be able to find that car. He was just, he was dying to find that car. And yeah. So were we. And thank God we found it.
as far as Mike's Nova, we had a friend in high school that had one. It was primer gray, raked, badass. And one day he was like, hey, why don't you guys, let's go.
I mean, when I first saw that, I was like, holy shit, he's driving a V8 Interceptor from Mad Max.
I know. Well, that thing had like the 428 big block in it too. I mean, it got down the road. So he took us, my buddy took us to lunch one day, and he's like, come on, hop in the truck. And we hopped in that, and he hit it, got into a nice, you know, long, safe stretch of road, and he hit that sucker, and it flung us back in the seat, and we're, you know, faces peeling. And it left such an impression on us and emotional scarring that we were like, Mike Handel has to drive that badass car. And
it just became an extension of his personality anytime.
Well, it's beautiful because, like, you know, Hawks, even though he's fucking shredded, he's kind of got that unassuming physicality. And then when you put him in that and he floors it, it's just, yeah, it says so much about the character.
Yeah, if you had a car like that, it would partially define you, no question about it. I always think about the boys in Supernatural with their car who are just like, don't touch the car. If I had that car, I'm not really a car guy, but if I had a Chevy Nova, I'd be a car guy.
we went and picked it up because we had to search high and low. We found one an hour away that we drove out and got. And we've never gotten so many thumbs up in our lives as we were screaming back down the freeway.
Nice.
So did you keep it?
I wish.
You know, unfortunately, to pay for post, we had to let it go.
Oh, man.
One of those lifelong decisions that will haunt us.
Yeah.
In an ironic twist, the guy who sold it to us very begrudgingly sold it to us. He had built it from scratch. He loved it. And he contacted us on Facebook and was like, hey, you know what happened to my car? And we're like, actually, we do. And I believe he got his car back.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, so great. Now, when you make the sequel, you can do, you know where to find it.
Yeah, and he'll be like, "I'll just get it back afterwards," yeah, and you'll exactly. be like, "Nah, we're richer now. We're keeping it."
We're like, "No, we're gonna put it in a movie." He was like, "You're not gonna put this in a movie, like, dude. We're putting it in a movie." He's like, "Well, is it gonna be prominently featured?" Like, "Oh, it's gonna be prominently featured." Like, can it really burn out and like do all the stuff we needed to do? He's like. And he was like, oh, yeah.
Because he built it. He built it for a quarter track. So when we got it, it didn't have, you know, great brakes. Power steering. And we told Hawks, because it's just built to go straight.
So, real fast.
Yeah, so Hawks were like, hey, man, take it for a spin. And he takes it around the block. He comes back in. He's like, okay, I love it, but we're going to need some brakes and some power steering.
You know, not the sort of thing you want to find out after you got hit 60.
Yeah.
God ended up doing about 99% of all the driving in the movie.
Yeah.
And so he went out there. He's like, I want to take – we had this stunt guy on set, and we were like, hey, you know, John wants to take a spin at this and for as many as is safe for him to do. And he absolutely did it, and he crushed it. I remember after one impressive, like, gravel-spewing 180 where he zips on down the road, he comes back, and the stunt guy's like, John, do you do a lot of driving? He's like, you know, I drive my car around L.A., but he's like, once I get in this car, Mike Kendall takes over.
He was straight up Jim Garner as Jim Rockford in the Rockford Files and that. Like, you know, I was like – you know, it's like Jim Rockford has such a relationship with his Grand Am, and it just felt the same, you know. And also the fact that Jim Rockford is yet another one of those private investigators that is regularly getting the shit kicked out of him. That was like kind of one of the bells that this movie immediately rang with me.
Okay, guys, you ready to talk about the Rockford Files for 30 minutes? Because now that he's gotten started, I don't know if we can stop him.
Dude, yeah, like every classic amateur sleuth has their hot rod life. Like Magnum had his Ferrari.
Yeah.
Right? Ferrari? Am I wrong?
I think it is
Ferrari. Yeah, Ferrari. Yeah.
So. I think sometimes.
You have a good...
It had a horsey on the emblem, so it was a Ferrari.
Yeah. And then as far as Clifton Collins goes, like his character, was surprised when you come back to him. And you make him one of the primary characters. He felt like at first, like, oh, he's an amusing little side character here. He's probably going to get shot. And then it almost felt like when you first came up with the character, that's what he was. And then you were like, you know what would be funny? If we take this character who is supposed to be someone else and make it Clifton Collins. It really kind of had that feel about it. Was he always planned to be that big a part of the third act?
He was. When we started building the idea, one of the things we came up with pretty early on was, like, wouldn't it be awesome to have this, like, kind of team of misfits growing up against these professional hitmen? And those just ended up being the misfits that we came up with in the script.
But Ian and I, in our writing process, we don't – like, on this one, we do another project. But on this one, we didn't do a thorough outline. We kind of just took it as it came to us. And, you know, occasionally we got in some pinches where we had to work our way out of it and figure it out. But, yeah, we didn't do a thorough outline. So it was when we got to the moment where Steve and Mood team up.
It just felt like it needed to happen.
Yeah, it just felt like, okay, this could be really, really cool.
Because Mike's like, I need some help. And it's like, okay, who's he going to get? Like,
is he going to get Vartan?
We literally went through at that point in the script, we literally are going through, okay, which of all these characters we've come up with, like, which one of these, as I said, misfits, like, what's going to make the best kind of misfit matchup? And who's the most incentivized to go out there and do it? And, yeah, I mean, you could have had, like, Vartan out there or even Octavia to some extent. But it made the most sense to us was the pimp because it's his girl. And he can't look bad for having his girls be taken out. Like, he's going to lose his other girls. He's got a heart of gold, man.
It's such a great, like, Elmore Leonard-esque twist is really what it felt like to me. And I just thought it worked so well. And, yeah, as we kind of went on several different riffs on the review, we're just like, we want a sequel just so we can see these guys work together again.
I would watch a spinoff about Clifton Collins.
Oh, absolutely.
To be fair, but he is the type of character that needs his balance, you know? Or it almost feels like if you had another movie with Hawks, some other extreme wacky character like that. Like, in my head, I kept seeing Don McManus as, like, a in-the-mountains hippie guru drug dealer type, you know?
If we did a sequel or a series, I mean, it would easily be Clifton, Bob, and like they would absolutely be like reoccurring or if not a, like a staple in his detective agency.
He's his Huggy Bear.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just a great chemistry to all those cats and gals, and they just, I don't know, like I said,
they played off each other really well.
Yeah.
Too.
Now it's Katie and John. Oh, now it's Robert and Cliff.
It felt like a set that, even though you guys were, you know, dealing with very intense material, that people were enjoying themselves on.
Yeah, I mean, every scene felt like Christmas, as we had, you know, another amazing actor coming in to be with John or on their own, or, you know, even kick in a door and blow somebody away. It was a lot of fun stuff with a lot of great people.
Let me just say as well, it was a pleasure to see Katie on there, because I'm a unabashed dork. I watch all the CW superhero shows, and she's one of the best things on all of them. And I'm like, oh, it's my lady Katie. Okay, I'm settling down to watch this. Was she really cool?
She's super cool.
Amazing.
And she's all business, man. She comes. I mean, you know, when you say action, man, she brings it. She does her homework. She shows up. And she's on the money when she gets there, which is great. You know, you watch her do it a couple times. You say, "Hey, try something." Yeah,
can't wait to do it again with her.
Yeah,
and she's such a physical actress. I was actually kind of surprised y'all didn't say, "You know what? Let's turn out that she's got like a black belt in martial arts and gets to kick everybody's ass in one scene."
Yeah, I didn't realize that she was like an amazingly accomplished breakdancer, and she's just, you're right.
Really?
Her physical prowess is really intimidating.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that she was super excited about, is she was like, oh, I get to just play like a nice girl in this one. I don't have to like a nice prostitute, but she's like,
with a heart of gold.
She told us, she was like, I'm this is fun. Like, I don't have to like break out the baton and kick anybody's ass, or like, she's like, I'm a girl, you know, I'm a victim here, possibly, you know. She was having fun playing that other side of it, because usually she's just whooping everybody's ass.
Which, you know, I like, but regardless. We got to move towards the end here, because actually I have to be on someone else's podcast, if you can believe that. But I wanted to ask you what you guys have coming up next.
We just got attached to a film for the guys who do John Wick. It's titled Capture right now. And yeah, we're
working on putting that one together.
Working on putting that sucker together right now.
Nice. Can you tell us anything about it? Like the plot?
Yeah, it's about a guy who is falsely accused of a subway bombing, and then chaos ensues as he's trying to sort of prove himself, and as everybody's kind of after him.
So action oriented, you might say.
In the vein of The Fugitive.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Some run Fugitive, and then, you know, some other fun things that aren't in The Fugitive, obviously, because of the time and whatnot. So
our current social media world.
Exactly.
And you're working with Thunder Road, so does that mean you're getting to inherit some of their stunt coordinators?
God, let's hope so.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because they're really good at what they do.
We haven't gotten as far as putting our crew together yet, but yeah, we're moving forward with it, and we're just tidying up and getting ready to head out to cast.
Yeah, and then we're doing a series with Octavia Spencer.
Nice.
Oh, wow. Well, what's that called?
We don't have a title for it yet, but it's like a little like sci-fi thing. So,
ooh, yeah, cool.
We can't get into it too much, because she doesn't want us to pull the sheet back yet. But yeah, we're excited about that one too.
So one last thing before we let you guys go. Is there any story that you want to tell about the making of Small Town Crime that didn't make it onto the Blu-ray extras? Or you know, any kind of last point that you might want to make?
A bon mot, if you will.
Yes.
I mean, I guess for me, it's just if you had told us, I think just being this for the right reasons, if you wanted to pursue film and cinema and the arts, it's 99.99% of us, it's not an overnight success thing. It's a lot of hard work and a lot of grinding. So,
but I will say it can be done. Esh and I didn't know anybody when we came into town in 2002, and we definitely didn't have a fallback in mind. It was just like, okay, this is what we're going to go do now. And of course, we've had a million odd jobs and jobs to back us up to pay the rent. But as far as like where we're headed and what we're doing, it's always been making movies. And when we landed in town in 2002, we realized pretty quickly you can't just kind of sit around with scripts. You have to like go make them. So in 2003, we shot our first feature film for $1,500, and that's what he bought the camera for. And it's like, it can be done, and it can be done for no money. And we made it into a bunch of film festivals, and that's what hooked us right there. When we saw people reacting to our work in a movie theater, it was incredibly contagious. And we didn't get into Sundance with our $1,500 film.
Not Sundance.
We got into a bunch of, you know, the humble the humble film festivals. But again, we're in AMC's. We're in real theaters with real people watching the movie, and they're enjoying it, and they're reacting to the places you want them to react to, and, you know, feeling emotional and laughing at certain points. And it's just, it's addictive, man. We couldn't get enough of it.
Well, I think Octavia gave us some really cool advice. She said, just do one thing for your career every single day. And obviously,
I feel like Hawks has a similar attitude.
Yeah.
It's just, if you break it down that simply, it doesn't feel so daunting, you know? And if you just do one thing to move yourself forward in the direction.
Even if it's like, I'm going to put out this email, this really well-written email today to, you know, a certain couple of people and see if I can open a few doors for myself. Even if it's something that simple that you do that day.
Yeah.
Like, it's those tough. Are the things.
Yeah, because it's tough because we're all like, look, everyone's got their day jobs, you know? You're grinding 9 to 5 and it's come back. You're like, okay, well, if I can just do one thing that's going to get my life going in the direction I want.
Yeah, that 3 or 4 hours I have left in the day that I didn't have to work, and I can work on my art or work on creating a path for myself. Like, that's the most important thing you do.
Yeah, and our sincerest thanks to everybody who watches, listens, enjoys cinema. It's why we do it. And thank you all so much.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Guys, we're extremely grateful for that driver who rear-ended Ash. I think he's done us all a favor. And we're really looking forward to seeing your guys' future output. We love this movie, as you could tell. And thanks for reaching out for us and talking with us today.
Yeah, very much.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks, gents.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.